You are listening to Sheep Might Fly, a podcast of serialised fiction written and read by Tansy Rayner Roberts. Our current fiction serial is The Season of Dragons. Chapter 3. All these country dances blur together. Assemblies, I am told, when one lives in and around a tiny thatched-roof town, such as Merriwest, refers to a series of rustic gatherings in which the same 25 families gather to practice their galliards and eat lukewarm savouries while attempting with little tact or decorum to marry their children to each other. This is not what I call an assembly, but I suppose not every young lady of quality gets to come out at a King Street ball sponsored by the coterie. I'm well aware of how lucky I have been before my foolish brother snatched this season away from me. During the first fortnight we stayed at Elderflower Hall, we were invited to 3 assemblies, each as dire as the last. Were it not for the new hats that my maid had trimmed for me, with amber scale lace and cerise ribbons, I would have quite lost the will to live. At home, Abeline would be bursting into life and fire, as the dragons awoke, and gold-edged invitations blanketed the city like the best kind of smog. I'd already received 2 letters from Kitty Hendricks, and 3 from Emma Watling, describing all of the marvels and gossip I'd missed so far. Here in Merriwest, our only consolation was a supper room full of moulded jellies, and a town hall full of moulded gentlefolk, all placing bets on which of their beribboned local swindlers would get her grubby hands on my brother's fortune. I remain convinced, though Dido tells me I'm being unkind, that 2 of the 3 dances, if not the whole set, came into existence purely because the locals were so excited at the appearance of a marriageable gentleman in the neighbourhood. At the first assembly, Chambray danced every dance, a pair each with myself and Dido for the sake of respectability, then a pair with a daughter or two from each of the higher, if such a thing is worth noting, ranked families of the locality. Dido, who had quietly procured all manner of advanced intelligence by way of our new housekeeper, gardener, and butcher's boy, ensured that he chose appropriately. This was all well and good when it came to Miss Ellis, the daughter of the local squire, who was plain and intelligent-looking, and thus no danger from any direction. Or even her younger sister, Sophia, who was slightly prettier, but not of an age to be actively hunting a husband. No, the danger came from an entirely different direction. That family with 5 unmarried daughters. Mr. Bellamy, Chambray had assured us, was a capital fellow with a dry wit. What he had not revealed is that the family were from a long line of hunters. I'm sure we looked quite the snobs, standing stiffly in our formal lace and linens, while this raucous family tipped into the assembly hall behind us. But once I recognised the tiara pinned to the curls of the eldest daughter, I found it hard to breathe, let alone make polite courtesies. Rackham froze like a statue at the sight of it. I did not blame him in the least. While it is true that many of today's fashions are inspired by our country's love of dragons, witness my amber scale lace, perfectly replicating the popular scooped pattern found on many a dragon's flank. We have moved beyond the grotesqueries of the past, such as the outdated tradition of wearing trophies of murder and cruelty. At least, those from our sort of family have moved on. Apparently, the daughters of dragon hunters find it perfectly appropriate to wear the spoils of massacre and murder to a country dance. Miss Leda Bellamy, the eldest daughter, wore a tiara that had to be a century old, completely out of fashion, and glittered with diamond scales from a dead jewel bag. Jewel bag dragons were mostly extinct these days, largely because so many hunters had murdered them for these trinkets. It was appropriate to keep such an object in one's family hoard, if you must, to acknowledge the sad crimes of the past. In Abilene, anyone who wore such a thing in public would be cut direct, and would find every dance invitation for the next 5 years dry up like dust on the wind. Even hunter families in the city understand the basic courtesies of public attire. "People do things differently in the country," murmured Chambray in a low voice, patting my arm, as if worried I was about to leap into action and tear the wretched tiara from the horrid Bellamy girl's head. "Not everyone can afford new jewels."
"Then they should not wear jewels," I hissed, my nails pressing into Dido's wrist.
"Ivarwald," said Rackham, in a hoarse voice. "What exactly do you know about that Bellamy fellow?"
"Why, that his eldest daughter is dashed pretty," said Chambray, a sulky tone taking him over, "and I shall dance with her as many times as I am allowed."
Now that we came to examine them, every Bellamy daughter had some kind of distressing trophy upon her bosom, her throat, or her hair. One wore pearls wrapped around a single opal tooth. Another wore a copper locket embedded with the kind of amethyst that can only be mined from the eye socket of a hibernating hydra. The mother, who was loud and exuberant, ushering her daughters this way and that as if they were princesses of the realm, carried an antique purse of embroidered wyvern silk, an elegant term for a product made from flattened wing skin. And the father, retired gentleman he might be, but this was a formal occasion, and so he wore the sash that displayed his shameful career for all to see. 15 dragons dead at his hand. I have known hunter families before. Several of them sent their daughters to my school. But there was usually a sense of restraint when they moved in polite society. Discretion about their blood-stained history. The Bellamy family were entirely shameless about their origins. Clearly a popular group, they were warmly greeted by friends and acquaintances as they paraded around the hall. No one seemed to find their dress the least bit distasteful. Thank goodness the place was deprived of spare gentlemen. None of the locals approached me to dance, protected as I was between my sister and her husband. Chambray tried to encourage Rackham to join him in frolicking with equal abandon through the 25 families of the Merrywist social whirl, but Rackham sensibly demurred. By the second assembly, 6 days later, another week of Abilene revels missed in order that Dido and I might take tea in a draughty manner while our gentlemen enjoyed long muddy walks and contemplated the benefits of owning more than one dog. We were prepared for the worst. I'd been asking a lot of questions, spending enough money and time at the milliner's, the circulating library, and even the sweet shop, to gather local gossip. That was how I learned that there were hardly any dragons in the county. Society dragons, that was, but... oh, there were a few distant aunts or godfathers who occasionally visited, but this was a rarity. The Ellises had a high patron, but she was in long hibernation and rarely made an appearance. As for the rest of them, what dragons had lived here once
had long since died, or crawled away into the mountains, or let themselves fall into permanent sleep, eternally stone. No wonder the people of Merriwest threw country dances without any sense of originality or style. This was a town bereft, drifting along without the proper guidance of their betters. This also explained how the Bellamy family could wear their tacky battle souvenirs without social consequence. The second assembly was less of a shock to the system. Now I knew what to expect. Those Bellamy girls had a limited selection of gory ornaments with which to pair their home-trimmed gowns, and I had quite braced myself to see the dreadful items on display all over again. The ghastly mother was no better, even if one prepared oneself to have courtesies hollered at us from afar. She never moved once she'd found a comfortable seat at a public event, expecting her family to run around fetching her drinks and sweetmeats, for all the world as if she were her family's patron dragon. Whomever had raised Mrs. Bellamy, and she did seem to have some formal courtesies about her, had never taught her to be discreet about her opinions. She visibly twitched with tactless annoyance when Mr. Rackham did not fall over himself to compliment her or her daughters. She then almost strained herself in switching from grumpy to sunshine when Chambray swept by with the eldest Miss Bellamy in his arms. I thought enough to make polite conversation with some of the locals this time around. Sophia Ellis, younger daughter of the local squire, was quite a charming little thing, complimenting my lace in a stumbling manner. She later confessed over lemonade that the town had been rife with rumours ahead of our arrival, to the point that they expected my brother to bring a party of 12 ladies and 7 gentlemen to the hall with him. "Goodness," I said, without much thought, "how extraordinary to imagine so many might travel away from civilization at this time of year." Sophia coloured a little, and it occurred to me later that she might have thought it an insult. I danced with Mr. Rackham, each of us agreeing in undertones about how the local gentry were tripping over themselves to hurl their daughters at my brother and his 5,000 a year. He, that is, Mr. Rackham, was greatly relieved that the same locals had dismissed him as far too disagreeable to be worth his far greater fortune. If only dragons had learned how a scowling countenance is the best way to turn fortune hunters from their caves, I teased him. How many more might be still alive today? It is a useful shield, the gentleman confessed. Malachite is bordered by 4 villages, I said, as the thought occurred to me. Do they make you dance and throw daughters at your head? Rackham was always less grouchy at home, though he had never insisted we join him at a single local assembly. "I cut the occasional ribbon for them," he admitted, "and judge the village fairs. But none of my local gentry have marriageable daughters, so I am quite safe from dancing and supper parties, except when visiting my aunt." I shivered at the mention of his aunt. All dragons must be revered and respected above all things, but some are downright terrifying, and Lady de Bramble was one of those. After our pair of dances, Mr. Rackham and I were free to stand and survey the room, making light and amusing conversation, until Chambray pounced upon us. "Rackham," he exclaimed, "I must have you dance."
"You know what a punishment it is for me," Rackham sighed. "Meeting new people is bad enough, but to stand up with fresh acquaintances." I tweaked the sleeve of his jacket. "Such a chore it is, to learn new names and their fathers' professions and think of three original things to say about the same lavender muslin gown made over in six different ways. How you must suffer over under the weight of it." "Please," said Rackham, giving me a smile that was part infuriation and part charm. "No true gentleman has less than six prepared statements about lavender muslin ready to go at any given time. Luckily for us all, no dance in the land is long enough to provide the opportunity to share three original thoughts." "I don't understand the pair of you," said Chambray, who had never developed the ability to read sarcasm. "I love to chat during a dance. One can find out so many things about another person when one is genuinely interested." "Yes," I said, my humour taking on a sour note. "I imagine you have gathered dozens of facts of interest about Miss Bellamy by now. Must you dance with her so many times? You'll give her mother ideas." "If Rackham would dance with more local ladies, I would not feel so obliged to make up the difference," Chambray scolded. "Yes, I am sure my participation would regulate yours," Rackham sighed. "But as you have monopolized the only pretty girl in the room..." I stepped on his foot. "Present company accepted." "Too slow, Mr. Rackham," I said, and opened my fan with a flutter. "I'll leave you to your assessment of the locals. But please, brother, try to dance with someone who hasn't matched her ball gown to a piece of dead dragon before the night is over." I later heard that a different Bellamy daughter, Laura, the one with the eye socket amethyst, spent most of the evening mocking Mr. Rackham for being too proud to dance with the local girls. It was all I could do not to scratch her eyes out. It should hardly be a surprise to this reader that I had no wish for my brother to choose a bride in this oubliette, far from polite society. If I were to be held with a musket to my head and forced to choose, my preference would be Miss Alicott Ellis, Sophia's elder sister. Their father was Sir Willem Ellis, the town squire, and it was he who hosted the fortnight's third assembly, more of a tea party, really, with a few set dances in the drawing room. But I was kind enough not to call attention to that fact in front of anyone. It was clear by now that our new neighbours were to be pitied, not scorned. Miss Ellis might not be as pretty as Lydia Bellamy and her sisters, but she was capable of making clever conversation, and actually took an interest in the world beyond Merriwest. Quite a contrast to Miss Bellamy, who stood in a rather frozen manner when addressed, only showing the faintest glimmer of warmth when my brother spoke to her directly, and even then hiding most of her face behind a lace fan. More to the point, the Ellis family were hoarders, not hunters, which made me far more comfortable under their roof than I might have been in other local houses. Their patron, the gracious great-aunt Agatha, sneered grandly down at us from an oil painting in the hallway, her wings spread wide, and a beaded lace fichu adorning her sapphire chest scales. "She only awakes from hibernation every 3 or 4 years now," Miss Ellis told me, looking rather wistful. "I had hoped the promise of a party might bring her out of the greenhouse this season. Next year, perhaps." It was an anxious time when an aging dragon was due to emerge from hibernation and chose to skip one more spring and summer. No one knew better than I how that felt, though I could not shut away the hope, as Chambray did, that this year might be different,
Our countess could be awake right now, and none of her human family there to greet her. Yes, Miss Ellis was very promising. Sadly, she was 27 years old, and had so thoroughly resigned herself to spinsterhood, she barely even tried to catch Chambray's eye. As soon as the Bellamys made their entrance to the Ellis Assembly, late as usual, the younger two sisters still arguing as they strode in, as if this was some common or garden chop house, and not a respectable home. I winced to see my brother's face light up like a lamppost. Miss Ellis saw it too, and turned away with a smile even more wistful than the one she had worn when discussing her family's sleeping dragon. "Do engagements move more quickly in the country?" I asked Dido with concern, as I watched Chambray fill a plate of refreshments for Miss Bellamy, picking radishes out of a perfectly satisfactory salad in order to please her. She had left her tiara at home for once, and was gazing at him like he had conquered an army to save her salad from radishes. "I'm sure there's no danger," said Dido from behind her fan, though I could see she was biting her lip. "You know Chambray. He's enthusiastic around everyone." I frowned, thinking her far too optimistic, and I could see from the crease between Rackham's eyes that he agreed with me. Thanks for listening to Sheep Might Fly. This podcast was recorded on Palawa land. I acknowledge and pay respect to the Tasmanian Aboriginal people as the traditional and continuing custodians of Lutruwita, Tasmania. Sheep Might Fly is produced and edited by Andrew Finch. You can sign up to my author newsletter for updates. Follow me on Instagram, Blue Sky, or Threads at TansyRR. And if you like this podcast, consider supporting me at Patreon, where you can receive all kinds of bonus rewards, early ebooks, and exclusive stories for a small monthly pledge. It is May, and on the 15th, if you missed my Kickstarter last year for Time of the Cat, the book will be available for sale, for general sale, for the first time. Thank you to everyone who came by the Indie Book Fair this week here in Hobart, Tasmania. It was an amazing event. I always enjoy them, but the new location is just lovely. It was really nice to be part of the Salamanca Market event. And yeah, it was lovely to meet lots of people. I hope some of you are listeners. I will see you next week for more Season of Dragons.